Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
Thanks for listening again. I'm Matthew Gage, and this is Baptist Basics University, lesson number 9 in our series, our Bible Survey series. And today we'll be wrapping up the New Testament with looks at the general epistles and Revelation. So, what we're going to cover today are just the last few books of the Bible. And a lot of these are pretty short. You get into, you know, 2nd and 3rd John and Jude, they're very short. But these are letters, epistles, books, whatever you want to call them, that were written not by Paul. That's basically why they're grouped together. All Paul's books were grouped together, and then these were kind of grouped separately, separately from Paul's. And sometimes you'll see the non-Revelation books here. Let me talk about them for a second. Hebrews, James, 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude. Sometimes you'll see those referenced as general epistles, and that kind of goes to that their message is more general. It's not that they were writing to a particular church or people like Paul did. And their messages tend to be a little bit more universal and not dealing with, you know, specific issues like Paul would do, like in, you know, the book, his letters to Corinthians, dealing with specific problems in Corinth. Sometimes they're also referred to as Catholic epistles, or I think, what's the other one? Universal epistles? I can't remember the other name sometimes. But that's far less common, mostly probably because Protestants don't like using the word Catholic, which just means universal. And I would kind of agree. General just kind of sounds better. But sometimes you'll see them referred to as that. And then we also have the book of Revelation we'll get to. And boy, if there was a book in the Bible that defies going over and glancing over in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, it is the book of Revelation. But we're going to do our best to do that when we get there. Revelation is the only prophetic book in the New Testament. And it's not that there's not prophecy, that, you know, Jesus didn't have some prophecies, that he did, you know, look at Matthew 24 and stuff like that. But the book of Revelation, pretty much the bulk of it, not all of it, but the bulk of it deals with things that are to come, and the end times and the tribulation and the millennial kingdom, and even going into, you know, the eternal state beyond that when time is no more. So anyway, we got quite a bit to cover here. Don't want to sound like this is going to be just a quick little roundup. Boy, we could get lost, especially of the bookends, Hebrew and Revelation. We could so get lost in either one of these books, and that's not discounting the other books at all. Okay, so we'll go ahead and jump right on in. Hebrews, the book of Hebrews. We don't know who wrote it. And I kind of teased this a little bit in the previous lesson, but most people believe that Paul wrote it, but they'll have to admit we don't know. Paul's name is not attached to it. Now, there could be good reason for that. If he was writing this for a more of a Jewish audience, well, Paul's name was anathema to the Jews. I mean, at the end of a, like a Jewish synagogue deal, they would actually do this deal, and that's where the word anathema comes. I may not get this exactly right, what they used to do, but they would actually, like the rabbi would lead them in saying, you know, like anathema somebody, and basically, I mean, you'll curse them. And they would do this just, you know, to remind people, you stay away from those people. They're cursed, you know, and kind of to mark them. And Paul evidently was one of those guys whose name would come up and they would, you know, say anathema Paul, or I can't remember exactly how that little ceremony went, but it happened. And so Paul, you know, was not the most popular guy with, you know, the Jewish rulers. Number one, because he was so effective, you know, he was one of them and became a Christian. So kind of, I guess they could see him as a turncoat of some sort. But also, he was so persuasive in his logic and in his presentation that a lot of times they were just outmatched and outclassed by him. So they hated him. So if he wrote this book, he may have very possibly left his name off. Now, It's also interesting, if you look at the other books of Paul, they almost always will start with something like, Paul the Apostle, you know, to the church at Corinth, or something along those lines. But almost always in the first verse or two, it'll say something about, you know, Paul, I'm Paul, and I'm writing you this letter, you know. And the book of Hebrews starts out with God, who at sundry times and diverse manners spake in times past unto the fathers by the prophets. So it like skips Paul, and he just goes, who cares about Paul? God is telling you this. So, but anyway, Paul is the one that most people believe wrote the book of Hebrews. The other name sometimes attached to it is Apollos, who we see in the book of Acts, who was also a very persuasive and eloquent man, and a man that evidently God mightily used also. But we don't know who wrote it, but I'm pretty sure and pretty certain from what I've read, and there's stylistic studies and things people have done say, oh no, Paul couldn't have wrote this, or yes, Paul did write this. There's tons of debate on this, but I think it's pretty safe to say if you had to pick somebody, it was Paul. And so that's why I'm just saying who the author of Hebrews is. I don't know, but it probably was Paul. Now, when was Hebrews written? It was written late 60s AD. You know, since we don't know who wrote it, it's kind of hard to date it. But this is going to be a little bit later there in the New Testament period, late 60s. The theme is heaven's last word, and the purpose is to show the superiority of Christ. Basically, this is a final take on the place of Christianity compared to the Judaism. And it's not saying that, you know, Moses was bad or anything else. It's just saying that Christ fulfilled it, that Christ is better than. And in fact, that's kind of one of the key words in this book is better than. And in fact, our outline is kind of based on that. But basically, you know, this is saying, you know, this is the final word for God. And basically, this is trying to wrap up in one book, explain that Christianity is not a new thing. It's, you know, it's a continuation. It's a fulfillment of what the Jews have believed. And, oh, yeah, also, hey, you remember all those guys in the Old Testament? Yeah, they were saved by grace through faith, too. So a lot of this deals with the Jewish religion. There's a lot of allusions to Jewish doctrine and belief and practice in this. But a wonderful, wonderful book. One that, I don't know, many preachers, many people will claim as a favorite, and one tremendous one to study. Not that all of them aren't, but Hebrews, just, it is a very special book. And the key verses, we'll just say, are chapters 1, verse 1 through 2. I've already read chapter verse 1, but we'll read again. It's still good. God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in times past unto the prophets unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the world. So let's say, just kind of getting it set off and showing right away. He's saying, you know, yeah, I remember all that, but now, you remember the prophets, but now God is actually speaking to us through his Son, not a prophet, through his Son. You know, so kind of showing the supremacy, superiority of Christ. And our outline is going to be based around this. Chapters 1 and 2 is Christ is superior. I don't know how that came out like that. Superior to the angels, chapters 1 and 2. In fact, this is verse 4, being made so much better than the angels. So it's kind of the theme there. And it kind of gets a little sidetracked from that too, but that's the general outline. Chapter 3, verse 1 through 4, verse 13, is Christ is superior to Moses. I'm looking to see, I don't have that one underlined. I had the one about angels underlined, but I don't guess I underlined that one, but it's in there. But, so, anyway, but that's the next section. It deals a lot with Moses in that. Chapter 4, verse 14 through 10, verse 18, is Christ is superior to the priesthood. So this really kind of takes it up to the next level. 4, verse 14, seeing then we have a great high priest that is passed into heaven, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. And just talks about how superior he is. It talks about the order of Melchizedek, which I don't think anyone understands in chapter 5. and just keeps going, compares them to, you know, in chapter 7, keeps going with that. Talks about the priest, you know, after Aaron, and talks about them just, then it goes into the sanctuary and the sacrifices in chapter 9. So, and great stuff. And it really kind of tries to put, you know, what was the purpose of all that, of the priesthood, of the sacrifice and everything. This really kind of helps you to understand how that relates to Christianity, how it's signs of things to come. In fact, that's, where does it say? Chapter 10, verse 1, for the law having a shadow of good things to come, you know, that all this stuff really is kind of looking forward to the cross and Christ, and that Christ fulfills it all. Okay, boy, I'm preaching in the outline. Finally, the fourth section would be Christ is worthy of endurance by the Christian. And that's chapter 10, verse 19 through the end, chapter 13, verse 25. And the key passages I just go ahead and tell you probably ought to know is, and probably the most famous chapter in the book of Hebrews is kind of the Hall of Faith, Hall of Fame, whatever you want to call it, chapter, the faith chapter, that's chapter 11. And that really is where the author of Hebrews, you know, Paul, where he's laying out and proving to the Jews, going, you know, almost all the way back, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, I can't talk, you know, Joshua, Rahab, and, you know, and he basically just has to quit, and he's only got through, you know, the book of Joshua, you know, he's still got a bunch of Old Testament to go through, but basically just proving that all these people had faith, that faith wasn't a new thing, that's the way it's always worked. So that's a tremendous chapter to know. And then there's also some great verses on faith, going back into chapter 10. There's a little bit, kind of that section actually kind of starts a little bit before chapter 11. But anyway, that is the book of Hebrews. Now, the book of James. Book of James may have been the first book that was written. And the rest of these, whoever that's named after wrote it. You know, well, until we get to Revelation. But the next few books, whoever wrote it is the name of the book. James wrote the book of James. And there's a lot of you, and there's a bunch of different Jameses, but you'll see him referenced in Galatians chapter 2, verse 9. Anyway, James was written about 50 AD. And let me go and get this out of the way. The book of James has been a little bit of a controversial book through the years. In fact, Martin Luther, actually, I read somewhere, Martin Luther said that it shouldn't even be in the Bible. And because it deals a lot with very practical stuff, and it deals quite a bit with works, the works a Christian does. And you can see where a guy like Martin Luther, who's, you know, rebelling against the Catholic faith and is, you know, pushing for salvation by grace through faith, not of works, lest any man should boast, you know, anything that says works, you can see him just kind of pushing it out of the way. But James is not saying works is for salvation. It's saying works because of salvation. And that's really in chapter 1. It gets very deep into that. But I don't want you to be confused. And some people steer away from the book of James, and I've never had a problem with it. It's always made good sense to me. The theme of the book of James is the testing of Christians. In fact, the outline I'm going to use, I think I actually got this from J. Vernon McGee, is a list of, well, the seven things, but there's six tests that, you know, kind of a Christian goes through and will test to see if a Christian is a true Christian. And the purpose is not to test and say, hey, this is how you see if a Christian is a real Christian. It's more ethical instruction for Christians. It's trying to help Christians know how they should act, what they should be. Key verse, chapter 1, verse 22, but be ye doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. So there's a lot of the impetus of James is action, is doing. And that really is summed up so great in this verse. Because, you know, not just hearing the word, but doing it. Don't be deceived. If you just hear it, it's not enough. You have to do it. Our outline. This is one that it's kind of all over the place. It's not a very clean-cut outline. Chapter 1, verse 1 through 18 is the purpose of testing. And that really gets into a lot of the faith versus works. And he's like, you know, you say, show me your faith. He's like, you know, I want to see your faith. I want to see your works. You know, I'll show me your faith by my works and stuff like that. Chapter 1, verses 19 through 27 is the test of obedience to God's word. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 13 is the test of partiality. Who do you love? Chapter 2, verse 14 through 26 is the test of works, test of your works. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 12 is the test of the tongue. That's another very strong passage in here that tremendous, to read and a challenge about how we speak and how we ought to be careful about what we say. Chapter 3, verse 13 through chapter 5, verse 6 is the test of ambitions. Riches and worldliness and stuff are covered there. Chapter 5, verses 7 through 20 is the last, and that's the test of patience in prayer. Really summed up in 5, verse 16, confess your faults one to another and pray one for another. So, anyway, that's the book of James. And I don't want to make it sound like it's a horrible book, because it's not. I love the book of James. I enjoy reading it. It is a challenge to me. It's a very practical book, and probably because of that, because of the emphasis on, faith and works, and if you have faith, you'll have the works to follow, and showing someone your faith through your works, is a very practical book, and it is a great challenge to Christians. Next, we have the two books of Peter, written by the Apostle Peter. Yes, the Apostle Peter who denied Christ and, who's preached at Pentecost, that Peter. That's who we're talking about. 1 Peter, we're going to say, is written about 64 A.D. A.D. 64 is really how you should say that, because it's Anno Domini in the Latin, which means year of the Lord. So, in the year of our Lord, 64 A.D. and the theme of it is persecution for Christ. And it's really written to encourage suffering believers. It's not the key verse, but chapter 1, verse 7, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So, and actually, this had very wide, if you read, chapter 1, it's talking about the to the stranger scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. That's all that region, kind of modern Turkey up there right now. So this had very wide circulation when it was originally written. And evidently, they're going through some hard times. They're facing some persecution. And this book basically was written to encourage them. Let's see. Key verse is chapter 3 and verse number 18. For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit. So, talking about the example of Christ and salvation that he bought us. Outline for the book. Chapter 1, verse 1 through 9 deals with suffering and security. The security a believer has through suffering. Chapter 1, verses 10 through 25 deals with suffering in the Scriptures. Kind of how it relates to the Scriptures and the scriptural basis and that we have there, verse 25, but the word of the Lord endureth forever, and this is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. So it really, kind of goes back to the Bible a little bit there. Chapters 2 through 4 is suffering and Christ's suffering. So we kind of, say, hey, look, Christ suffered too, far greater than we ever could. So if we suffer a little bit, in his name, it's nothing compared to what he did for us. And chapter 5 is suffering and the second coming, and which has probably some of the more memorable verses where it talks about 5 verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil is a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. Anyway, but that is the book of 1 Peter. 2 Peter, written about the same period, AD 65, we'll just go ahead and say. And the theme about this is, the theme and purpose have to do with false teachers. The theme is pretenders present dangers. That, that these false teachers that have come in, there's a danger to them, a danger to what they're teaching and what they're presenting. The purpose of the book is to warn against these false teachers. chapter 1, verses 3 through 4 is our key verses. According to his divine power hath given unto us all things that pertain unto life and godliness through the knowledge of him that hath called us to glory and virtue, whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, that by these you might be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. That's kind of setting the high tone for the theme of the book. And chapter one, our outline, basically, you know, just three chapters, three divisions. Chapter one is developing as Christians, the Christian growth. And chapter two is where it really gets into denouncing the false teachers. And then chapter three is dealing with the difficulties of the last days. And kind of talks about... really kind of the darker view of the second coming. Not so much of it as a hope, but you know, talks about in verse 3, knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from beginning of creation. It's kind of putting in place the theme of the false teachers. Like, okay, this is supposed to happen. But the day of the Lord, you know, will finally come. And that's the book of 2 Peter. I really didn't do a very good job on that one. All right, now we get to the three epistles of John. This is John, not John the Baptist, John the Apostle, John the Beloved. And he wrote five books in the Bible. He wrote the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, so four books named after him, and then Book of Revelation. 1st John is the longest of these three epistles, and we're going to go ahead and give a date of all of them. They're probably very late. We're going to say 90 AD, very late in the life and ministry of John. The theme for the Book of John, Book of 1st John, is fellowship with God. And the purpose of it, what I've seen is attributed is dealing with heresy. I'm not sure I would necessarily go straight to that, him like calling out people, but he is really trying to get his point across. The key word, I think, for the Book of John is probably love, and what is true Christian love, and you know, don't love the world, but you know, love God. And but anyway, yeah, he's definitely trying to get a point across to the people he wrote this book, and really trying to get his message about how a Christian ought to live. And John has said, according to tradition, that you know his saying that he was famous for was "Brethren, love ye one another," or "Children, love one another," something like that, you know. And there's quite a bit in the book of 1 John that deals with the topic of love, especially you get into, there's a section, chapter 4, it's in there a bunch. And it gets into, "Beloved, let us love one another," is chapter 4, verse 7. "For love is of God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not, knoweth not God, for God is love." And I mean, just goes in and really skewers it and says, you know, look, if you're a Christian, you don't love your brother, you're probably not saved. You don't have the love of God. Because if you have the love of God in your life, you would love your brother. I mean, it's pretty harsh when you're dealing with what seems like a very positive topic of love. But I mean, he's really getting down, putting it where the rubber meets the road. Okay, an outline. Chapter 1, verse 1 through 2, verse 2 is God is light. Chapter 2, verse 3 through chapter 4, verse 21 is God is love. And then chapter 5 is God is life. Now, 2nd and 3rd John are both very short books. In fact, in my Scofield Bible, they're facing each other. 2nd John's on one page and 3rd John's on the other. And 2nd John has 13 verses and 3rd John has one more at 14. You know, they're very short books. And doesn't mean you need to look over them, and even though stuff is hit pretty quick, there's still good stuff in these books. Once again, I'll say 2 John, 90 AD, somewhere around there to be written. The theme is judging false teachers and dealing with heresy. Now, I mean, that is really just a few verses here, but when you're dealing with 13 verses, you know, hey, it's not going to be very long. But it once again, he's just trying to get that out. Verse 7. For many, as our key verse, for many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. So he's addressing these false teachers and this doctrine, you know, pointing them out. An outline is amazing to get a three-point outline out of a, you know, 13 verses. But commendation of the church, verses 1-4. The command to love one another, verses 5 and 6, and the caution concerning deceivers, verses 7 through 13. And now, the book of 3 John, written 90 AD, somewhere around there. The theme is joy and hospitality. This is just really more personal. This is a personal letter to Gaius. And we're not exactly sure, I don't believe exactly who this Gaius is, but this letter has been preserved to us. The key verse is verse 2. Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth. And this really is kind of it's got a very sweet sense to it, but it's also... It's compare and contrast between some different characters. Gaius, Diotrephes, boy, that's a fun one. Diotrephes, I think how you say it, and Demetrius. And kind of their character. Verses are outlined, verses 1 through 8, we have the hospitality of Gaius commended. And this talks about kind of thanking him of what he's done. Verse 6, which have borne witness of thy charity before the church, you know. So it's kind of talking about and thanking him for what he's doing and the good works he's done. And then verses 9 through 11, we have the inhospitality of Diotrephes. Man, you think that name's hard. I'm tripping up on inhospitality. But anyway, but the inhospitality, I think that's how you say that, of Diotrephes, condemned. I usually do really good on these names, or at least try to, and that one has just got me. But anyway, but it talks about this guy who loved to have preeminence among them, received us not, you know, was not kind to us. So anyway, kind of comparing Gaius to this guy. And then we have Demetrius in verses 12 through 14. Demetrius is introduced, and, you know, it says, Demetrius hath good report of all men and of the truth itself. And so, you know, we kind of have these three individuals, these three examples of good and bad in the book of 3 John. Not much bigger is the book of Jude. And Jude also is one chapter, 25 verses, written, we're going to say around 67 AD. It's kind of a little bit harder to place. Jude is the brother of James we see in verse 1. And the theme is judgment on apostates, those that have turned from the truth. And purpose is to warn Christians against false teachers. And we see that as a common theme, but you have to realize that at this time in the early history of the church, you know, there was a purity to the early church and a purity to the motive and doctrine and the actions of the early church. Well, these false teachers were beginning to come in and trying to put their own spin on it for their own gain, or trying to infuse, you know, Greek philosophy in with it, or trying to infuse, you know, some of the old practices of Judaism into it, and trying to add to or complicate the gospel. And it was a big deal as this is starting to come out. You know, the first few years of the church, there's really not that big an issue. But as the church continues to grow, and even today, it's amazing. You look at all the so-called things that are called churches out there, and they, none of them believe the same thing. I mean, some, they even call themselves a church, will deny that, you know, like the deity of Christ. I mean, it's crazy how spread out and how fractured Christianity is. And all that's just because of all this false doctrine and stuff that has come in over the years, and those that have chosen to accept it. And that's what these guys were trying to address at the earliest stages. The key verse of the book of Jude is verse 3. Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and to exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. All right, outline of the book of Jude. We have the occasion for the epistle, verses 1 through 3, the occurrences of apostasy, and that's verses 4 through 16, and then we have the occupation of believers in the days of apostasy, that, you know, we're supposed to stand firm and you know, not let it, you know, keep going. And that's verses 17 through 25. That brings us, after 30 minutes, to the book of Revelation, which, oh my goodness, if we could cover this in less than 30 minutes, we'd be doing good. I'm going to try to cover it in less than 10, just to hit the highlights. Book of Revelation, written by John. I went ahead and put that in the notes just because Revelation didn't write the book of Revelation, okay? John wrote it. Written around 95 AD, and the story behind the book of Revelation is that John has been exiled to the Isle of Patmos, which you can go visit if you want to. It's still there. It's a rocky little island. There's not much there. And John is exiled there for his preaching. And, sorry, I'm squeezing a drink in there. John's been exiled there. Well, while he's there, God speaks to him through visions and tells him to write this message down and to distribute it. And he has messages for some local churches, and he also has a glimpse into what is to come in the future. I mean, all the way into past the rapture and the tribulation and the millennial kingdom on into, you know, the eternal state. What happens when all of that is done? The theme of the book is to describe the return of Christ. Now, the second coming of Christ is kind of twofold. You have the rapture, and if you're a pre-trib guy like me, you have the rapture, and then you have Christ's return at the end of the tribulation to set up his millennial kingdom. And that whole kind of thing there is kind of described as the second coming or the return of Christ. And the purpose of the book is to assure of the ultimate triumph of Christ. You can imagine at this time, it's pretty dark days for Christianity. It's not legal. They're being persecuted, late in the first century. They're not very popular, you know. So here it is this glimpse into the future, and some of it's not good, the description of the tribulation period especially. But it is a sense that, hey, despite of what's going on now and what's going to happen, it's just like the song says, I've read the back of the book and we win. The key verse will be chapter 1, verse 7. Oh, let me get out of Jude. Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him, talking about Christ, and they also which pierced him, and all kindreds of the earth shall wail because of him. Even so, amen. So, I mean, the theme of the book, it's mostly about the end times, and Christ is the central figure to the entire book. Okay, let's deal with an outline, and we'll try to cover different topics in the book of Revelation as we deal with this, because the book of Revelation is open to some interpretation. And let me go ahead. I've talked about this before in some of the other things. When it comes to prophecy, you can't really be sure about prophecy until it is fulfilled. And a lot of this has yet to be fulfilled. So we can make some good guesses and we can try to interpret it to understand what's going to happen. But people have done that before and we're wrong. How did the Jews miss all the prophecies about Christ? And even to the point of, you know, like we talked about in the book of Daniel in 70 weeks, to the very day Messiah is cut off, you know, how did they miss that? They did. So, you know, we could be looking at this and missing it, but I don't think we are. And I think really the last century or so, there's been a lot of great stuff come out about the book of Revelation. I think we have greatly advanced in our knowledge of it. Part of that is because I think the world is taking shape for these end time events that are described. So they're making more sense to us. When it talks about, you know, every eye seeing something, you know, 100 years ago, that didn't make sense. Now with television and satellite and, you know, and computers and internet, that makes sense, you know, that everybody could see it. So, you know, there's things like that that are beginning to make more sense. You know, how could there be one kingdom or one guy ruling the world like the Antichrist? Well, you know, 100 years ago, that seemed pretty crazy. It doesn't seem so crazy now having a one world government. You know, there's conspiracy theories, you know, about the Illuminati and different people even doing that. So the New World Order and things like that. So, I mean, you know, it's some of this stuff is it really is beginning to where it makes more sense to us. And I think that's because as the hour grows closer, we begin to see it. It's like the prophecy is kind of like describing the shadow of the object. And as you get closer, the clearer and clearer that shadow becomes, and you begin to see exactly what shape it is, and until you actually see the actual thing that's creating that shadow. And as we get closer to these events, what it actually the outline, the prophecy becomes clearer, and then we see it, and they're like, "Oh yes, okay, I understand now." So, but anyway, I am a pre-tribulation kind of guy. This is my outline, kind of I go by with the end times event. The next big event is the rapture, when Christ returns to call his saints out. That ushers in the seven-year tribulation period. The first 3.5 of that goes along, okay, the Antichrist is reigning. At the end of 3.5 years, he breaks a treaty with Israel. And for the next 3.5 years, hell on earth is not even good enough to describe how awful things are in the second half of the tribulation period. At the end of that 7-year tribulation period, Christ comes back. The Battle of Armageddon takes place, and Christ defeats his enemies. He rules and reigns for 1,000 years, the millennial kingdom that was promised all the way back in the Old Testament for the Jews. It happens. Christ rules and reigns as king over the earth. At the end of 1,000 years, Satan is loosed again, and for a short season, he actually deceives more people, and at the end of that, he is defeated once again and bound up to be done away with forever, and that kind of ushers in the eternal state where, you know, the saved and the unsaved are split, and the saved go into, you know, everlasting damnation, while the saved go into you know, the pleasures that will await us, you know, being with God through eternity. So that's kind of a very rough outline of kind of the pre-tribulational series of events. And some people believe differently, but I think if you read the Bible and take it pretty literally and not try to look too deep into it allegorically and stuff, I think it's pretty clear that the pre-tribulational rapture and that type of outline. That's what I think. Other people don't, but that's what I believe. You know, when we get to heaven, we'll find out I'm right. You know, when the rapture happens before the tribulation, I won't be disappointed. Somebody else may be disappointed, but I won't be. So. Anyway, Book of Revelation, chapters 1, verses 1 through 8 is the introduction. And chapter 1, verses 9 through 20 is a vision of Christ and his majesty. Talks about seeing Christ. Christ speaks with him, and he sees him and describes him walking among the candlesticks. And then verse 19 and 20 is the command that he's given to write down this vision that he sees. Now, chapters 2 and 3 are the messages to the seven churches. And some people take these to be prophetic, that these are seven ages during the church, and that, you know, we are now in the very last days of that, and, you know, all this waiting for is rapture. Some people take these to be, simply letters to churches that existed at the time, and regardless if they're prophetic or not, that's what these are, is that these are messages Christ gives to these seven churches, to Ephesus, to Pergamos, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Laodicea, I skipped one, Ephesus, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, there it is, it's hidden down there, and Laodicea. And we could go into each and every one of these and the things that Christ says to them. And there is a school of thought that says these are different church ages, and that the first one is like the first few hundred years, and then the second one is, you know, a certain period. Now, Schofield's outline is a little bit jumbled up and probably not the best presentation of that. Honestly, I'm going to tell you the truth. I've seen both arguments, and I still don't know exactly what to think about it, but a lot of people will tell you, you know, when you look at, if you read about the Laodicean age, boy, that's the age we're living in. And, you know, could be. I do think we're living in the last days. So if that is prophetic, that's where we're at, because I think we are in the last days. And then at the end of chapter 3, verses 20 through 22, they'll say that's, you know, Christ at the end of the church age, the stay of the church. You know, he's at the door knocking. He's not even inside the church. And so anyway. But that's the vision or the messages to the seven churches. Now, chapters 4 through 20, the bulk of the book deals with the tribulation period in the millennial kingdom. And it's kind of difficult to make sense of it. It'll kind of jump around a little bit. Chapter 4 and chapter 4 and 5, I believe it is, take place up in heaven, and we see, you know, Christ is given a seven-sealed book, and then chapter 6, they start pulling off these seals and the things that happen. And all these are judgments upon the earth. Chapter 7 then kind of goes parenthetical. And then chapter 8, when the seventh seal is pulled, it's the seven trumpets are the seventh seal. So then there's seven trumpets, which are, you know, more things that are happening. And then that gets to chapter 10, which is parenthetical again. And let's see here. Chapter 11 kind of deals with some events in tribulation period and the two witnesses that come. The seventh trumpet finally is the end of chapter 11. Chapter 12 is another kind of a parenthetical deal where it talks about symbolically Israel and Christ and Satan and kind of Satan's hatred for Israel. And then that really sets up and gets into the beast and the Antichrist that begins to come in, chapter 14 deals with the 144,000, those that will be saved during, you know, saved and be witnesses during the tribulation period, kind of showing, you know, it goes from showing, talking about the beast and how awful it's going to be, and then it's like, okay, but wait, there's hope, and oh yeah, they're going to pay for it too. Then it ends up with Armageddon too there, and chapter 15 is the seven vials start up, and it goes into chapter 16, which are more judgments. And let's see here, Chapter 7 to 18 kind of talks about Mystery Babylon. Some people take that to be the Catholic Church or some kind of the corrupt form of government and church that exists during the tribulation period. And then finally back in chapter 19, we get kind of, we have the marriage of the Lamb, and then the second coming of Christ, the Battle of Armageddon takes place, and, you know, Satan is defeated. And bound, chapter 20, he's bound. And that's, you know, kind of having the millennial kingdom there, which is really kind of glossed over here. Then we have the final showdown with Satan. Satan's loose in verses 7 through 10. Talks about that in chapter 20. The final doom of Satan and the unbelieving. And then chapter 21 deals with the new heaven and the new earth. This is not necessarily, you know, when you die, you go to heaven. It's not talking necessarily about that. This is what takes place after, you know, in that eternal state, after everything else has been fulfilled. And very well could be a glimpse into heaven. But some people get confused a little bit with what he's talking about here. And, you know, he's talking about this new heaven and new earth. It's you know, it's new. This is going into the eternal state. And then finally, there's kind of a final message. And I'm getting ahead of myself. Or I got to go in. The fifth section is the kingdom of heaven, which is chapter 21, verse 1 through chapter 22, verse 5. And that's what I'm talking about, the eternal state, the new heaven, the new earth, the new holy city, Jerusalem, and all that. And then finally, chapter 22, verses 6 through 21 is kind of an epilogue, and it's a challenge. It's a last word by Christ to his to the churches. And I kind of love the way it ends, you know, as John's finished writing it. Verse 20, he which testifieth these things saith, surely I come quickly. Amen. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. I mean, it's like, you know, Jesus said he's coming, and yes, Jesus, please hurry. I love the way, you know, John is even looking at that. And I don't think that's, you know, him trying to escape death or the hard times he was facing. I think that was he got a glimpse of what the wonderful things that were in store for the child of God, and he wanted to get going with it. So that wraps up the New Testament. I can't believe it. We're done. We've got through all the books in the Bible. That's amazing. If you've stuck with me, I appreciate it. I know we kind of glossing through this and reading over outlines is not the most exciting podcast out there, but I thank you for listening if you've made it all the way through there. I hope this has been a help and a blessing to you, to help you understand what the books are about and a little bit about them historically, and the outlines and the purposes and themes and the dates and the history. I hope you've learned something in this study. I know I have in studying. It's been great. You know, sometimes we just get to reading through the Bible and just studying the doctrine of the Bible. We don't step back and really study about the books. And I've learned a bunch in just putting this together. I've really enjoyed this study. But we're not done yet. Just like I did last time, I'm going to tease the next lesson. Lesson number 10, which I have not yet put together the notes for as I'm recording this. I'm going to start doing that pretty much as soon as I quit recording. I'm going to deal with the Apocrypha, those books of the Bible that aren't in the Bible, or should we say the books that some people claim should be in the Bible, or maybe think they are in the Bible, or whatever. But those books, real, fake, whatever, we're going to talk about what they are and kind of how to deal with them. And I hope that's a help to you. Because like I said in the introduction to this whole series, when you don't, you see all the time somebody say, "Oh, this is the lost book of the Bible. Oh, you know, we found this book, and wow, this sheds such new light." And usually, it's garbage. And that's why I want you to know, as we've covered the books that are in the Bible, I want to talk about the books that aren't in the Bible. I'm not talking about every book that's ever written. Some of these books are historically accurate. Some are just fakes and frauds that are attributed to real individuals. But regardless, we're going to deal with those books that didn't make it into the Bible in the next lesson. So I'm looking forward to even just studying that a little bit. I that's something I haven't put a whole lot of study into myself. But anyway, I appreciate you listening. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. If you've made it through this this far, made it through our whole going through all 66 books of the Bible, I thank you. And email any comments, podcast@baptistbasics.org. Visit the website, baptistbasics.org. You can like us on Facebook. I've got a Twitter account, @baptistbasics. I don't do much with that. I'd appreciate it if you leave a rating on iTunes for the podcast. That would be a blessing. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear from you if you get a chance, whether Facebook, Twitter, email, whatever. But anyway, that's it. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening today.